From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We begin today with Rodney Davis. He spent a decade representing Central Illinois in the U.S. House of Representatives. His 13th district stretched from Champaign County in the east through Decatur, parts of Bloomington and Springfield, and out west to the Mississippi River and the Illinois suburbs of St. Louis. The district was drawn that way to at least be competitive for Democrats, but Davis repeatedly got the better of all his challengers on both sides of the aisle. Until last year. After Democrats redrew the district maps before the 2022 elections, Davis found himself in a much more conservative district. He ran for re-election, but lost in the primary to fellow Republican Mary Miller. Shortly after he left office, Davis took a job with a lobbying firm and is now managing director of Cozen O'Connor Public Strategies. I spoke with Davis yesterday afternoon about life after Congress, his election defeat, and the future of the Republican Party. Congressman Davis, welcome back to the 21st Show. I try to be formal. How do I address you now?
Well, you clearly didn't dress me with enough respect before, so just Rodney now.
That's all right. All right. Rodney Davis, welcome back to the 21st Show.
Thanks for having me on. Great to be on with you again, Brian.
How are you finding life after Congress?
Nice. I mean, look, I had a six-month off-ramp, so I was able to prepare for life after Congress. I got a chance to not immediately have to quit everything cold turkey, but when I lost in June, I was able to, not have to come home and drive 3 hours to do events. I was able to come home and be home and really get reacclimated to my own home and my own community once again.
You know, that's something I think people don't often appreciate about people who go into politics, especially something like a member of Congress, where you're representing a lot of people in a big district. And you have always had to be on alert, right? Until 2022, your district was drawn to elect Democrats, and you were consistently targeted for defeat by the Democrats and, missed basketball games and school plays and chicken dinners. So, I mean, is there almost a sense of relief, I wonder, with the outcome of last year's elections?
You know, I wouldn't call it relief, Brian. I'm a competitor. I hate losing at anything. And I clearly did not want to lose the primary in June of 2020. So there's that competitive nature that you're just disappointed. You're disappointed that you didn't succeed. But is it relief? Yeah. Yeah. It's relief of now I own a lot more of my own time. And I was able to make decisions about how to use that time that was best for me and my family rather than what was going to be best for political issues or legislative issues, et cetera. One thing I was able to do when I got home was to clean out a basement that had been sitting for 20 years and added to by my boys and my daughter as they were growing up over the last 10 years.
So I want to ask about that election, because the Democrats in Springfield, supermajorities, they had free rein in drawing the new district boundaries. What do you think of their maps as it relates to you?
Oh, it's a gerrymandered mess. Look, they knew what they were doing. They decided to draw a district, in my case, put my home county in a district that was about 35% of my old district. And they knew it was going from an even district, as you said earlier, one that was competitive, that appreciated bipartisanship, that appreciated governing, to one that was an R+22. That was their way to make Republicans fight Republicans. And frankly, they got their wish. They got me out of Congress. And that's okay. I mean, I don't live my life for a title. I enjoyed my 10 years there. We got a lot done in those 10 years. And now I've moved on to a different job, and I've moved on to help others get elected. But J.B. Pritzker and Democrats in Illinois, they're just hypocrites when it comes to complaining about Republican-drawn maps in other states when they don't look inward.
As you're on the outside, you're seeing Speaker McCarthy trying to win the speakership earlier this year, and he's giving a lot of concessions to the Freedom Caucus in order to gain power. What's going through your mind as you're watching that?
Well, the question is, what did he really give? I mean, a lot of the so-called concessions were, easy concessions or things that were already planned before that speaker's election. I was doing commentary for three straight days on CNN about the speaker's race. So I was engaged. I was talking to my former colleagues about what they were seeing. And I was kind of given a play-by-play of what was happening on the floor. You know, why those two certain individuals that were on camera, why they don't usually talk to each other, why that's about the speaker's race, et cetera. So I was engaged in that process. But there's one thing that I found out about that process. Kevin McCarthy came out of that process stronger because 91%, 200 plus Republicans were with him every single ballot, and they were growing stronger and more unified as those votes went from the first vote to the second vote to the 14th and the 15th. And they were not going to lose to those five who were holding up the process of Republicans being able to govern. And they came out stronger, and those five came out weaker. But those five are going to tell you how they got everything. And in the end, the country got a more open legislative process, which was not the case under Democratic leadership. It would have been an open process I would have thrived in. And it's a process that Kevin McCarthy promised before he was even elected speaker. And now America sees that.
You know, you mentioned those five, the holdouts. This is the Freedom Caucus, Lauren Boebert of Colorado, for example. How did we get from where we were when you entered Congress, right? The ascendant people were people like Paul Ryan, who would go on to be speaker, policy-minded people talking about these big picture problems, to where we are today, to where the seemingly the most powerful, at least the best known members of the House Republicans are people like Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Well, number one, they're the best known because it's the media outlets that give them the most attention. It's pretty simple how that equation works out. They get more attention, they get more discussion, they get more popular because they fight for a certain segment of their respective party. And Democrats are no different when it comes to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, when it comes to Ilhan Omar and others. However, I would argue when I got to Congress 10 years ago, those far-right individuals were there. We just had a bigger majority. So we got through the speaker's vote in one vote rather than having to be beholden to five people. But what has happened since then is that Washington itself and all levels of government have become more polarized. And frankly, both parties have become more polarized and beholden to the far end of their political spectrum. It didn't start with Republicans and Donald Trump. The Democrats had the exact same problem with Bernie Sanders before Donald Trump. It just got nuclearized in the Trump era and then in the post-Trump era. That's where we are today. And the small margin that Kevin McCarthy has meant that it took him a little longer to get elected speaker, and he'll probably be a better speaker for that.
I want to just remind listeners, we're speaking with former Illinois Republican Congressman Rodney Davis. And you mentioned earlier this idea of bipartisanship, and I do want to spend some time talking about that. There's this group, as you well know, called the Lugar Center, which rates and ranks members of Congress on how bipartisan they are. For the sake of our listeners who maybe are not as familiar with it, I want to take a minute to just explain what their scores try to measure and what they don't. They have this complicated formula for assessing lawmakers based not on their votes, but on how many bills a lawmaker sponsors with members of the opposite party. So during your entire decade in Congress, you typically ranked very high in the top 6% of all members of the House, Democrats and Republicans across the country. To help listeners understand what the Lugar Center thinks this says about a lawmaker, I want to read what they say about it. They say, a consistently low score on this index will be a very strong indication that a legislator is viewing his or her duties through a partisan lens. Conversely, a consistently high score is a strong indication that a legislator is prioritizing, problem-solving, and open to working with the other party when possible. And just to bring it home, in 2021, the most recent year for which data is available, you were the highest scoring member of either party from Illinois. Do you know who the lowest ranking member in all of Congress was? 435 out of 435?
Are you asking me that?
Yeah, I am. Yeah.
I would say, let me see, was it Ken Buck?
It was Congresswoman Mary Miller. The irony, Rodney. What do you make of that? You're the highest ranking member in Illinois. She is the lowest ranking member in all of Congress. And the voters go with her. I wonder what that says about governing and bipartisanship in 2023.
Well, it doesn't say anything about governing and bipartisanship. What it says, it's about the districts we run in. It's about the constituency that we're drawn into. And that's what they prefer. That would be a bonus. Look, I found out during the primary of this year that it was not a good thing to be ranked 14th out of 435 in the Lugar Center bipartisan index. It was not good to be ranked number one out of everyone in Illinois, even though I kept hearing from many in the media and many of your listeners that somehow I was very partisan. And Brian, you know as well as I do, when you introduce me as former Congressman Rodney Davis, that is music to the ears of many of your listeners who fought very hard when I was in a different district to give me that title, but weren't able to.
No, that's very true. And I never quite understood the level of bitterness and vitriol out there. I wonder, you say it's about the districts you're drawn in. Is it tougher, though, to be a bipartisan member of Congress? I noticed it was interesting that in one of the previous years, you were ranked right next to Representative Elise Stefanik from New York, who has, the Lugar Center noted, had a very precipitous change in her score in the most recent session of Congress. Do you see people, as you said, it's harder in some of these districts to be bipartisan. Is that affecting the bills that people introduce and sponsor and who they work with?
Absolutely it is. But it also has to be recognized that a contributing factor to that is whether you're in the majority or the minority. Mm. And when you're in the minority party, there's one thing that I found, even in a 50-50 district like I had for 10 years, it was the partisans on your side want you to be more partisan. And in the end, as we see districts for the 435 members of Congress going into this new decade become more partisan, then it's going to incentivize that partisanship. I remember, I would stand shaking my head when I would hear my opponent get applause for saying back in the summer that we should not be engaged in Ukraine's battle against Vladimir Putin. To me, I'm never going to change. I believe that we stand up for democratically elected governments versus tyrants any day of the week, any week of the year, any year of the decade. Unfortunately, many in my party are taking now the same approach that many on the far left have taken. And that really changes the dynamic in Washington, which I think if my colleagues recognize that governing is possible, could be better for the country. But unfortunately, I've seen polarization win the day over the last few years most of the time.
How does that actually work, working with members of the other party to sponsor a bill? Are there meetups? You know, we hear a lot about in the olden days, Speaker Tip O'Neill would go have a drink with Ronald Reagan and that sort of thing. And now we hear that people are more segregated by party and ideology in the Congress. How do you actually find people to work with?
Well, it got difficult during COVID when Speaker Pelosi shut the floor down and made us vote in certain time periods. You lost an opportunity to go find a colleague on the floor that may have a last name that starts with a W, but I'm voting with the D's and E's. So that stopped bipartisanship opportunities. And then when you were there, they were trying to rush you off once you put your voting card in and cast your vote. That stopped bipartisanship. That led to more polarization. But now that we're back to normal, as promised under Speaker McCarthy and as promised by me years ago, now you can go find your colleague on the floor. And usually your staff has done some background work as to why any piece of legislation would benefit that member of the other party because of their district, because of an industry that's in their district, et cetera. And you go sell that bill to them. You say, hey, look, I've got a great idea. Take this pocket card back to your team and discuss this. And I was one that would be told by many in my party, don't co-sponsor bills with those targeted members. And I always remembered I was targeted. and I would get Democrats to co-sponsor bills with me. And as a matter of fact, I'll give you one story. I was mentoring a friend of mine who's still a really good friend, Carlos Curbelo. Carlos was a candidate in 2014 out of the Miami area in Key West. And I picked him to be my mentee for that great philosophical reason of I wanted to go to Key West. And Carlos called me during his first campaign against an incumbent. And he said, why did you co-sponsor a bill with my opponent? I'm like, I did. He's like, yeah. So I said, well, what bill was it? And he gave me the details. I said, you know, Carlos, I co-sponsored it because it's a good bill. I said, this is exactly what you're going to do when you get to Congress, when you find out you're in a bipartisan district and you're going to have Democrats come up and ask you to co-sponsor a bill. And you're going to say yes, because it's a good bill and it helps you in your district. And that's exactly what happened. He got to Congress for two terms and he did exactly that. And he even told me since then, he said, you know, I get it now, but gosh, that made him, he said, boy, it made me mad when you did it during the campaign.
Okay, we need to take a break. More on the 21st show after this. Stay with us. If you're just joining us, this is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Rodney Davis, who for a decade represented Central Illinois in Congress as a Republican. He was defeated in a Republican primary in a new district to incumbent Republican Congresswoman Mary Miller last year. Now he is a managing director at Cozen O'Connor Public Strategies, a lobbying firm in Washington, D.C. I want to ask you about that. So you're working as a lobbyist now, I would imagine you spent the last decade getting a lot more requests from lobbyists than you had time or interest to deal with it. What's it like to be on the asking end of that phone call or text message?
Well, I'm not on the asking end at this point because I have a year that I'm banned from lobbying the House and the Senate. And, you know, for me, it's really just a learning experience about how to work with clients, how to strategize. And what my colleagues have been using me a lot for is to engage with our clients when they're coming into Washington, explain to them what's most important about getting your message across at a 15-minute meeting with their member of Congress and their staff. I've been traveling around to our different offices that make up Cozen O'Connor, meeting my new colleagues, and it's really been a change. I've enjoyed it, being a multi-client strategist, consultant at this point, I think fits who I am because I didn't really delve into one issue or two issues when I was in Congress, like many of my colleagues. I passed more bills that weren't my committees of jurisdiction when I was in Congress than most members of those committees of jurisdiction because I realized early on Washington's not that strategic. And you can either be frustrated by that or you can figure out a way to make it strategic for you and your constituents. That's why I helped craft two farm bills. That's why I helped craft multiple infrastructure packages that have all become law. That's how I was able to get language put into the CARES Act that allows every single company in America to be incentivized to pay down student debt for their employees. But instead, all we hear about, instead of the laws that have already passed, ways to address problems that my constituents brought up, we had those successes. But in today's polarized environment, you hear on the student debt side, well, we're going to just expunge that debt, which I said from the beginning, Brian, was BS. And when the Supreme Court rules that it's BS, every single person who cast a vote based upon the promise of student debt should hold those leaders accountable who didn't deliver.
I want to spend some time talking about the future of the Republican Party and where it is, where it's going. But I think to do that, we have to look back a few years. And you've been quite critical of what you referred to as Pelosi's political 1-6 committee, January 6th committee. You were supposed to be on that committee until Democrats took the unusual steps, to say the least, of rejecting members who had voted to overturn the election results in those overnight votes after the Capitol was breached. Do you think it was ultimately a mistake for then Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy and other Republicans to decide not to participate at all in that committee?
No. And it was exactly what Speaker Pelosi wanted. It's how they strategized it out. You'd have to ask my former colleagues who were Republicans that served on that select committee whether or not they had discussions with the Democrats prior to Speaker Pelosi removing, ironically, just two individuals from Leader McCarthy's initial appointees. But I would guess those discussions happened before that decision was made. I am not about setting bad precedent in Washington. And the reason why Democrats like Eric Swalwell and Adam Schiff are not on the Select Committee for Intelligence in the House anymore, it's because of the precedent that Speaker Pelosi set. I will tell you, I would have liked to have been on that Select Committee. I would have liked to have had my colleagues who were selected with me on that Select Committee. And I guarantee you and your listeners this, Brian, the security posture of the Capitol would not have been left to be an addendum in their report. It would have been a major part of that discussion.
And I know you and some of your colleagues issued an entirely separate report late last year on that very topic. But you mentioned a moment ago your colleagues who were on the committee, Republican colleagues, Representatives Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger. How do you think they did?
Well, I'm not here to judge anybody's performance when it comes to legislating on a select committee that I thought was biased and very focused on one thing. Look, there should have been focus on President Trump's actions. There should have been focus on those lawbreakers who clearly broke the law by walking into the Capitol building and should be held accountable to the furthest extent of the law. I've said that since that day. It's a terrifying experience. Not my most terrifying experience in Congress, but one that was terrifying nonetheless, to get evacuated from the floor with my colleagues, to have to carry along with my former staff director, Tim Monahan, carry one of my colleagues, Ron Wright, down two flights of stairs because he was being treated for lung cancer and couldn't be evacuated that fast, couldn't walk that fast. Those things you don't forget. Coming back that night and doing our job to certify the election with the vice president and being one of the four tellers is something that something I'll be a part of when it comes to American history for eternity and for the rest of my life. And I was proud to be leaving that floor that day, doing our job. And unfortunately, we witnessed and America witnessed what happened that day. And I certainly hope Republicans and Democrats take a swift look and make sure that that never happens again.
Absolutely. We did witness it, but there's so many people out there, particularly on the Republican side of the aisle, who seem intent on, what's the phrase, memory holding that, right? Putting that, as Orwell said, putting that as something that, oh, it didn't really happen. People just walked in. People were breaking glass. They were, you know, armed with spears, if not firearms, wearing body armor. As you said, it was terrifying. Perhaps not your most terrifying experience. I presume you're talking about the shooting at the baseball practice there. And I know that there's this impulse to move on, but what does it say that people like Fox TV personality Tucker Carlson are spending a lot of time trying to rewrite this history? Do you worry about that? Is that bad for America?
Yes, it's bad for America. But I will tell you, the memory holding process is not relegated to Tucker Carlson. You mentioned the baseball shooting. I can go back and give you example after example of far left Democrats and Democrats and members of the media memory holding what actually happened that day, memory holding that somehow it wasn't a Democratic inspired activist screaming healthcare at us. I actually had a well-known reporter in this area, Brian, at one point sit across from me in the table when I was talking about that event, and he looked at me and said, "You weren't shot at." I'm like, "Well, what are you talking about?" He said, "Well, you weren't hit. You weren't shot at." I just, for the life of me, could not understand how somebody could rationalize a barrage of fire not hitting somebody as not being shot at when the individual was firing at all of us. But that's the memory holding that I see on other on the Democratic side, and I witness it on the Republican side. There's no way to brush aside the evidence of our officers that I thanked and hugged and talked to immediately after going back to the Capitol on January 6th when it was cleared. There's no brushing aside that they were attacked. There's no brushing aside the violence. We saw the violence. I witnessed the violence. And I'm not for trying to create a narrative that underplays that violence. But it's a problem that goes beyond what happened with Tucker Carlson on January 6th and the baseball shooter on June 17th of 2017. It goes to where we are today with what I would consider a narrow casting media environment, where it seems that we have media outlets and people picking their media outlets on social media based upon narrow casting versus broadcasting. And that has to be looked at, Brian. We can't continue to have a political agenda based upon where individuals choose to get their news. Otherwise, it's going to lead to further polarization, and it's going to lead to memory holding opportunities in perpetuity rather than really talking about what's true and what's not.
And that's something that we've certainly talked about on this program. And it's, what's that expression? You're entitled to your own opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts. But so many of us live in different fact environments these days. Looking ahead at the Republican Party, former Republican and House Speaker Paul Ryan has come out as never again Trump. And just this weekend, former Vice President Mike Pence delivered his most pointed critique of the former president since January 6th, when he said his reckless words endangered my family and everyone at the Capitol that day. And I know history will hold Donald Trump accountable. Where are you on former President Trump's campaign to regain the office? He and former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley are the only announced candidates so far.
Look, I don't think it's any secret that I'm not a member of Congress anymore because of Donald Trump. His endorsement, his sway, carried a lot of opportunity to increase voter turnout in areas that were not favorable to me, and his endorsement mattered in a district that was drawn by Democrats to elect somebody that would be aligned with Donald Trump. And I don't have any love lost for him endorsing against me and campaigning against me. So clearly I'm part of the majority of Republicans that polling consistently shows that don't want him to be our nominee in 2024.
What if he is the nominee again? Because there is this passionate base in the Republican Party. Would you campaign against him? Would you ultimately support him if he was the nominee of the party? Or would you go where Paul Ryan is, which is, no, we can't even support him if he's the nominee?
I believe Paul Ryan was asked, would you go to the convention in your home state if he was the nominee? Not necessarily delving into hypotheticals. So,
well, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I heard him a long interview with Paul Ryan by Charlie Sykes, the former Wisconsin conservative radio host who himself became a never Trumper in 2016. And I thought Speaker Ryan was pretty clear that Trump is over. And his perspective was Trump's a loser. And that's how you actually reach Trump voters, is that Republicans can't win with President Trump. That was his sort of overall stance.
Well, I agree with Speaker Ryan. I don't think we can win with Donald Trump. He already lost to Joe Biden, who frankly was one of the worst candidates that the Democrats could have put up in recent history. A little better than Hillary, but still, in my opinion, a terrible candidate. But in the end, I think Republicans are going to have to come together, just like Democrats did in 2020. Donald Trump lost the election because Donald Trump couldn't quit being Donald Trump. He couldn't show leadership. And in 2020, all Republicans saw their numbers precipitously dip after his first debate performance in September of 2020. He was able to regain some, but clearly not enough. In the end, I think Republicans will have to do what Democrats did in 2020. When they saw Bernie Sanders really marching toward the nomination, and that's when you saw Pete Buttigieg obviously begin the discussions about what cabinet position he wanted if Joe Biden were the nominee. Democrats came together to make sure that they stop Bernie Sanders from being their nominee. And Republicans may have to get to that point, because Donald Trump at this point in a field that is being projected is the front runner. And Republicans are going to have to come together and recognize that the majority of us Republicans do not want Donald Trump to be the nominee again, because no matter how much you love the guy, and I actually liked working with him, some of the best policies I was able to enact were signed into law by him. And I will not shy away from my record of working to make those policies into law, as I promised when I got elected. But Donald Trump is a loser. He lost the election to Joe Biden, and he will lose the election again and cost us many House seats that were won in 2022 in districts that Joe Biden carried just 2 years before that.
Looking back on your time in Congress, what is your greatest piece of unfinished business?
Well, my greatest piece of unfinished business was fixing some egregious provisions in the Social Security Code that are called the government pension offset and the windfall elimination provision. These punish public workers, our firefighters, our police officers, our railroad retirees, and even our teachers. And that was their number one priority to fix. And I got it further than any other member of Congress has in our nation's history. I got it on what they call the consensus calendar by getting over 290 co-sponsors. Instead of getting a vote on the floor of the House, as promised, the Speaker decided to have a hearing and a markup in committee. So it never saw the light of day on the floor. There's bipartisan scorn to passing those fixes, even though a majority of the House wants those provisions fixed. They punish our public workers. And that's one of the promises I made in 2012 that I wasn't able to completely fulfill. But the others, like creating a private sector voluntary solution to paying down student debt, done. Passing infrastructure bills and getting our infrastructure bills back on a regular consideration process, done multiple occasions. Passing a farm bill, done twice. So I like to think we had a pretty successful record, but I did get those provisions further than anyone ever has in our nation's history.
Will you be running for office again someday?
If I see you running for elected office unchallenged, I will challenge you, Brian.
Well, I can give you, unlike many politicians, an unequivocal no, absolutely not. You will never see me running for office, but you're still a young man. What does your future hold? I've read where you said never say never.
Yeah, that was because I had a local radio host after my primary loss ask me, and I said, no, I'm never running again. And my phone lit up because it became the news story. I should have known that my phone lit up when it appeared in local newspapers and on other media outlets like yours. And it was from those who supported me the most for 10 years, those who helped finance my campaigns locally, those who helped knock on doors. And they said, please don't say that. Please never say never. So I told them, for them, I'll say never say never, but I wouldn't hold my breath.
Rodney Davis, thank you for taking the time to speak with us today on the 21st Show.
Always glad to be with you, Brian.
More to come after a short break. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us.